Good morning and welcome to At Home This Morning, a magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a look at our world, both in and around the city of Brighton and Hove, and now even further afield, all for both our older listeners and those not so old. But before we go any further, I'd like to express my thanks and gratitude for the care and attention I received during my fortunately brief visit to A&E a few days ago. However, that's quite enough about me, as in the next hour we'll be hearing from Ross Penfold and Lynn Romeo about working in the care sector. I'll also be continuing my conversation with Brighton's Michael Edwards about his experiences in the recent veteran car run, and TV's Anna Richardson will be joining us with news on what we can learn from our feline friends. Plus, there'll be some guidance on how you can get the best deal and connection for your broadband with expert Alastair Golden, and we'll be joined by one of the stars of the hit musical Everyone's Talking About Jamie, that will be coming to the Theatre Royal over Christmas. Now, if you're connected to the internet, hopefully it'll be some kind of broadband connection rather than the old-fashioned dial-up. Well, to find out if you're on the right track, as it were, we're joined by Alastair Golden. And Alastair, just that, there are lots of different ways you can connect to the internet. How do you make sure you're on the right one?
What Swish Fibre are doing at the moment is you're trying to highlight to consumers the different types of fibre or part fibre broadband that's out there. So at the moment, a lot of people believe they've got fibre broadband when they've got part fibre. And this is a significant difference between the technologies used and the speed. So in part fibre, there is copper from the green cabinets in the street back to your property, whereas with full fibre, there is fibre optic cable all the way to the property. This has a massive and huge impact on the speed and potential long-term speed of the service that you receive.
And when you talk about speed, this is the speed in which your computer reacts to whatever it is you're trying to watch.
That is part of it. That's also something called latency, but what we will avoid that. So what we're doing here is the fact that speed is measured in megabits per second. We're using, in many cases, copper telephone lines originally invented by the Victorians to try and push down huge amounts of data. They've done a fantastic job for what they are, but going forward, the whole industry is moving towards full fiber. And full fiber currently, at Swish, we build 10,000 megabits per second network, access network. Works. And that is basically future-proofing us as the economy grows and we come out of the pandemic.
And how do you make sure that you're on that one? I mean, looking out of my office window now, I can see from a telegraph pole, there's a wire flies over the road and connects to the house. So presumably that's a bit of old copper, is it?
Not necessarily. We at Swish can use telegraph poles as well, then we can replace that copper wire with a piece of fibre wire. The best way to do it is see what sort of service you can be offered. So if it is a service below 100 megabits per second, so let's say the service being offered is 80 or 70 or 60, you're probably on part fibre network, which is a mix of copper and fibre. If your provider can provide you something much, much, much higher, like up to 900 megabits per second, then you're probably on a full fibre network. And that is important for consumers to know the difference, because full fibre, we believe, is an enabler. And it's an enabler for small businesses. Also, it allows people to do more things with technology at home, allows more people to work very stably from home. For example, if they're doing video conferencing or there are other members of the family at home using the internet, full fiber is a very stable platform and provides a huge amount of current bandwidth today and also going forward. So the fiber networks that we're putting in at the moment are probably going to be around for the next 40, 50 years.
How can people actually get a handle on what their connection is?
First of all, you need to obviously people look upon the various systems. I mean, if you go to swishfiber.com and register for it with us, we will provide information on the differences between full fiber and part fiber, and also how you can use the different services. And then from where your address is, you can look up on the various checkers and to see what is available. But if you go online, have a look and see what services there are and look at the speed, because part fiber networks are called fiber, and also full fiber networks have the same name. So you need to really look at the difference in speeds to tell the difference in technology. And that's the whole point of our campaign, is to clarify things in the wording and the description of the products for consumers. So at the moment, I have to explain it in this sort of long-winded way of looking at what speed you're getting, because the naming of the products can be confusing.
And that website address?
Our website address is swishfiber.com.
I was talking to Alistair Gordon about how you can make sure you're getting what you pay for with your broadband connection.
At Home This Morning has been a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb.
Now, we're told we're being encouraged to be a little bit more feline in pursuit of a better way of life. Well, somebody that can be classed as a bit feline is TV star Anna Richardson, who's joining us now. Hello, Anna.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
Oh, fine. But tell me, is it fair to call you a cat lady?
Well, I think it's very fair to say that I am a bit of a cat lady. I do love my puss. It's got to be said, Chris. I love cats very much. And any research about them, I am in, which is why this new report from Republic of Cats really tickles my fancy. So basically, it's suggesting that if we want to be happier and healthier as human beings, then we could learn a thing or two from cat behaviour.
And what sort of things can we learn, and how can we relax like cats?
Well, that's a very good point. Well, first of all, 82% of people who were surveyed said that they really admired how independent their cats were. So that ability to just brush off anything negative and walk away. And I think we could all do with a bit of that, couldn't we? Just sort of anything negative, particularly over the last 2 years, anything negative that people are saying, anything negative in the news, just to brush it off and crack on with your day. People loved that. The other really important thing is that cats are hardwired to just walk away from any activity that doesn't serve them or bring them pleasure. Now, again, as humans, I think that that's a really important message, that the ability to say no, that if it's not going to bring me pleasure, if it's going to stress me out, then I just don't want to do it. So I think that we could learn from that, the idea of just saying, I don't really want to do this. I'm going to politely decline and just walk away from it, just like my cat.
I mean, cats, we talk about we own cats. In fact, I think it's the other way around, isn't it? Cats own us.
I would say that's very, very true. I think we've all got stories, haven't we, about cats that have just appeared at your door. I mean, you know, throughout my life, I've had a variety of stray cats that have adopted me, not the other way round. So very much so. I mean, in fact, I imagine there's in a parallel universe, I imagine that there's a sort of a cat radio show going on at the moment where they're discussing human behaviour. So, yeah, they very much own us, not the other way around.
So what are the tips, do you think, that we can learn from cat behaviour?
I think that we need to get more curious, actually, to be honest. I think that, you know, cats are known, aren't they, for being inquisitive and curious animals. We know that the more we carry on learning, the more curious and inquisitive we are about the world and our communities around us, keeps us in tip-top shape, and particularly with our mental health. The other thing is we need to be getting more sleep as well. I mean, cats can sleep between 10 and 13 hours a day. Again, they're genetically hardwired to do that. But out of this research, it shows that 3/4 of humans are not getting the requisite 8 hours. So we need to learn to relax and to get more sleep. And also, I have to say, nutrition. Coming out of lockdown, a third of us are now, let's face it, a little bit overweight. And funnily enough, as are our cats. So we haven't been feeding them necessarily the right food. We've made them a little bit tubby, which is why Republic of Cats, actually, they're the first organisation to create bespoke food for your cat that's delivered to your door. So there's a great deal that we can learn from this cat census.
The lessons that we can learn, and we've touched on it already with cat behaviour. That doesn't mean to say we've all got to grow hair and spend all our time sitting on the settees, but are there some fundamental things that we can learn?
Yes, I would say fundamentally, make sure you're getting enough rest. Learn to be independent and just brush off any kind of negativity. Learn to sort of say no. If you don't want to do something, make sure you're being pushed towards something that gives you pleasure. So if you feel under pressure to do something you don't want to do, learn to be able to say politely, no, thank you, and just decline. Finally, stay curious. Stay interested in the world around you. Continue to learn. We know it has a whole host of health benefits, and particularly for mental health as well.
Too true. What about those that say, oh, cats can't bear cats? A message for them?
I would say, get on your back, show us your belly, let us stroke and tickle you until you give in.
I was talking to television star Anna Richardson about how and what we can learn from our feline friends.
On 97.2 FM and online at radioreverb.com, this is Radio Reverb. And you're listening to At Home This Morning, a programme for older listeners.
Now, listeners will remember in a recent programme, I was talking about the veteran car run to Brighton resident Michael Edwards. And Michael, I'm pleased to say, is joining us now. Michael, good morning. And how was the run for you?
The run, I think, was a great success this year because, as you know, Chris, there was a degree of concern about actually so many events over the last 18 months about whether they would take place or not. And the 2020 run had to be cancelled because of restrictions. And there was a fear afoot that the same fate might befall the 2021 event. But that didn't happen. The run did take place. The entrance was slightly down this year. Normally we have just over 400, maybe 420 entrants to the event. And this year it was 100 less. But even so, you know, 315 cars gathered just along the Serpentine on what was a really lovely morning. It was 11 or 12 degrees on the first Sunday in November, and some people were walking around in their shirt sleeves. And I wasn't one of them, I hastened to add, because I did feel the cold. But it was a good start to the day. Actually, it had been a really good start to the whole weekend, because I don't know whether the listeners are aware, but the Royal Automobile Club and the Veteran Car Club and other organisations, they put on a whole series of events leading up to that Sunday morning. And so there were lectures during the week at the Automobile Club on Pall Mall that were reasonably well attended. And there was actually on Regent Street on Saturday a gathering of 100 veteran cars and some other cars. So the pedestrians, the shoppers, anyone who wanted to come to London could walk up and down, and they had the chance to get very close to the cars, speak to the drivers, in some cases sit on the cars and have their photographs taken. So it was a great family event, and that was really well attended too. It's also fantastic for the shopkeepers, of course, on Regent Street, who've had a pretty tough time over the last 18 months. So the run-up to the event, I think, was a great success. And that was echoed on the morning itself. Pretty much all the cars got away. There's always a few slow starters on the start line on Sunday morning. Some vehicles do their best to make life difficult for their owners and for the drivers, and they won't start. But eventually they all started and pulled away, and we're on our way down to Brighton. This year, as in previous years, the route split at the point around Parliament Square, where some cars went over Westminster Bridge and some cars went over Lambeth Bridge. And that's all designed to reduce the congestion, because what you don't want with an old car is it puffing and panting along when it's very cold on a chilly morning, and then having the car stall. So by having less cars on the road, the cars get a decent run, they warm up and they perform better. So the cars came down through Purley, and we had our halfway stop at Crawley College this year that I think actually worked very well. There were one or two surprise roadworks that didn't help, but we all managed to navigate ourselves around that. And then we're off down through the villages where there was a really good turnout this year. In fact, it's difficult to know with certainty, but I think there were rather more people by the side of the road this year than there were in previous years. And then we hit Brighton Seafront. I mean, from a personal perspective, I was on Brighton Seafront by around 12:30, so just over 5 hours from leaving, which I think was pretty much par for the course for most people. So certainly by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we had a really good gathering on the seafront. And once again, I mean, the sun was shining. You know, it was up to 13, 14 degrees. We enjoyed each other's company. And then we went on our merry ways by about 3:30. So a good day.
A good turnout for people watching and helping push the cars if they needed it.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things that the participants do depend on are the marshals. There are different sets of marshals who populate specific parts of the course where there are demanding hills. And they either close the road off completely for the veteran cars, which is hugely appreciated, or they allocate one lane for veterans and one lane for moderns. And the marshals help to police that. And that is really helpful, because when you're going up a hill in these old cars, if you stop halfway up, you really won't get going again. You need to be pushed to the top, and that is not much fun. They might look like spindly old things, but most of them weigh at least 3/4 of a ton, which is not what you want to be pushing up a hill. So the marshals did a great job. And as I said, there were lots of people out on the route. Some people having barbecues by the side of the road and just waving us on. There are a number of pubs, I think at least 5 or 6 pubs exactly on the route. And so they always get a gathering of people that want to wave us on. And it's nice. It actually is very nice to have the support. And there's always a few familiar faces in the crowd. There are the same car clubs that appear year in, year out. And there always used to be a couple of ladies who used to dress in Victorian or Edwardian costume as well. I haven't seen those last couple of years, but they were a great feature. So always used to give them a very warm wave on the way down.
As an owner of the car, or the current custodian of your car, do you appreciate being able to take it on a run like that, despite all the effort that goes into it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, these cars need to be used. If they don't use, they start to fall apart. You know, they need the oils flushing around the system. But you know, we could take them out to many places, I suppose. But I think in the last conversation that we had, Chris, I talked about some of the historical background to the run, which I think is something which all of the participants are keenly aware of. You know, so many of us, we leave our front doors and we get into our cars and we drive off and do the shopping and go and see friends, and we don't give it a second thought, do we? And yet, in 1896, when the very first London to Brighton run took place, it was the first time that people could actually drive a car on a road at 12 miles an hour, you know. And so that required a huge amount of effort on the part of the car enthusiasts of the day and the legislators to get this through the House of Commons. And after that, it took a good 5 or 10 years before people fully and finally accepted the motor car on the road. It wasn't until I think 1920 or 1921 that there were more cars on the road than there were horses, you know. So even then, the car was not a regular sight on the road. And if you drive around Brighton now, all the roads are clogged with cars. Well, I have to tell you, in 1920, in some roads, you'd have been hard pushed to see a car, certainly parked out on the street. It was very much frowned on to park your car on the road in Edwardian times. It had to be parked away from the high road. And so the fact that we can now drive our cars on the roads is down to the fact that some people work very hard to enable cars to be on the road 100 years ago. So that I think is certainly uppermost in people's minds.
And of course, we have a green council in Brighton, and I don't want to get into politics and talk about any restrictions or whatever, because that's not the point of this programme. But how much difference do you find with today's motoring in Brighton, and indeed the run on its way down from London, than, say, 20 years ago?
Well, there are more cars on the road, and that is a fact, you know. When I was doing the run 20 years ago, there were probably around the same number of participants, veteran participants now, as there were then. But now there are hugely more cars on the road, modern cars that are on the road. And I think it's because many people have got used to travelling very short distances in their motor car rather than using other forms of travel. I know that when I was in my 20s, I used to travel everywhere by cycle. But then I wasn't carting around two children and lots of groceries at the time. So there are reasons for it. But there are more cars on the road. And I think I have a lot of empathy with the Green Council, and that they want to get cars off the road, and the cars that are on the road, they want them to travel less distance, and they want them to be emitting fewer pollutants. I think all of those are very laudable aims. What I would say about veteran cars is that my own car is a 1902 car, and at that time, there were a great many electric cars that were on the streets of not just the UK, but also in America. America was a real entrepreneurial area for the creation of electric motor cars, and they made huge strides forward in a very short space of time. And I think even then it was felt that electric cars were maybe less trouble, easier to maintain than those cars with internal combustion engines. The only problem that people had in 1902 about electric cars was that the batteries were very large and extremely heavy, and they didn't hold their charge for very long. So you couldn't do more than about 20 or 30 miles without stopping to charge. And I think that, let's face it, that is still one of the challenges of the current electric cars. Very good though they are, and very efficient though they are, they probably haven't yet quite got the range that some people might need to have for the journeys that they'd like to do.
What about hybrid solution? Is that something new, or going back in the depths of time, were the hybrid cars then?
Yes, there were. There were many different types of hybrid cars. And in fact, I was doing some research on a car called a Woods Dual Power that was developed again in America in the, I think it was 1920, where that car had access to an internal combustion engine and electric power as well. It was highly complicated, which probably explains why it never really was produced in very large numbers. I mean, even then, the American population was of a very significant size, and the demand that was laid upon the shoulders of motor car manufacturers was churning out cars as fast as they possibly could. And the reason why the Woods Dual Power was seen to be an interesting and useful car to have was because in those days it was quite difficult to find sources of fuel, petrol fuel, in some parts of America. So the dual power car with an electric dynamo in it provided an option which the drivers might find valuable. But because of the slowness of the development and the cost of the development, it never really took off. But I think we may have touched upon this in the conversation that we had a few weeks ago, but at the turn of the last century, it really wasn't clear that the internal combustion engine was going to hold sway. Even in the trenches of the First World War, many of the British trucks were steam-driven. Not so in France. France tended to have petrol-driven vehicles from the outset. But there was a choice of the internal combustion engine or steam. or electric. It was felt that each of those applications could have its own usage. And so they were followed on a parallel track. But as I say, the range of electric cars swamped them. And also it was quite difficult to maintain steam vehicles sometimes because the boilers had of those cars had to have boiler certificates that were quite expensive to get hold of. And so the internal combustion engine just went off. And as I say, as I always say, the rest is history. I don't imagine right now that steam cars will come back into operation, but certainly there's little doubt in anyone's mind, I think, that electric cars are here to stay, and they're going to be 30, 40, 50 years from now. They will be the cars that all of our offspring will be driving.
You're listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Brighton's Radio Reverb.
I was talking to Brighton's own veteran car expert, Michael Edwards, and you'll be able to hear more of that interview in a future edition of At Home This Morning. And in case you're wondering, well, flying machines, veteran cars, I think they go together, don't you? The Department of Health and Social Care has launched a new recruitment campaign. It's called Made with Care, aiming to encourage people across England to pursue a rewarding career in adult social care during the biggest period of change for a generation. Well, we're joined now by Chief Social Worker for Adults, Lynn Romeo, and also Ross Penfold, Senior Team Leader from Brighton. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Lynn, tell us all about this new campaign.
Well, we've launched this campaign and the aim is to bolster the workforce within adult social care. It's called Made with Care because we really want to raise the profile of the social care sector and give recognition to the vital work that the social care workforce do. It's very rewarding, uplifting work to do, to be working with people every day to make a real difference to their lives so that they can live independently as possible with good support and care and be part of their communities. Often I think people underestimate what a difference people working in the care sector can make to those people who have care and support needs. It's a fantastic work to be in, and I myself started as a care assistant many years ago and I've been in the sector ever since, and it's just an amazing area of work to do. We need to give it much more profile, much more support, and there are real opportunities for people with the right values, people who love people, people who like to be with people, to make a real difference day in and day out. And there are lots of opportunities to work in very many different areas within the sector, from working in care home settings with older people or other people, working with people with mental health issues, supporting them in their own homes or in the community, people with learning disabilities, and people with other care and support needs. So really varied work and lots of different pathways that people can choose as they go through their social care career.
What about remuneration? Because although money shouldn't necessarily be important, we know it is for a lot of people. So is it a reasonably well-paid job?
Well, I think you have to think about, obviously, when you come into an entry-level job at whatever career you go into, you know, you start with a particular amount of reward. And the thing to think about is that over time, you will become more senior, get more pay, learn new skills, get more training and support. And there are opportunities to get more reward as you go through your career. And there's a real commitment to try and improve the financial rewards that people get in this sector. And obviously through the pandemic, it's really highlighted how absolutely essential and critical our social care service and the people who work in it are to keeping people at home and keeping them well as possible. So I think there's a lot of work planned to try and properly recognise people in this sector going forward.
This programme, At Home This Morning, is for our older listeners, so it's particularly relevant to them. And if I can bring Ross in at this point. Ross, thank you for joining us. And what's your view about the work of a care worker?
Well, thanks, Chris. I do believe it's quite essential for the support staff to be able to reach out and have the adequate numbers of staff to reach out to care in the community for a starting point to the older generation. You know, there are people that are on their own and families are becoming a little bit more distant at times. They're moving away, and actually we're quite relied upon. Quite central, quite key worker. You know, I think that's been raised in the last year and a half more so than any time before. I would definitely say that, Chris, actually, there's a great niche out there, and the career that we're able to make as a carer nowadays is phenomenal. The mass training that's provided for us to go up the ladder personally is fantastic, but also the more staff, we can reach out to more people as well. That's what I would say, Chris.
Now, what about our listeners, if they're old? Should they be worried about a stranger coming into their home or wherever it is they're living?
Well, Chris, I mean, I would say that would be down to, let's talk about the DBS. You know, people are very much checked to ensure that they are safe to work and have a duty of care within their role. I think along the way, there will always be someone that maybe doesn't take a fancy to one carer to another. Maybe the relationship does break down at times, but I think that's just humanistics. But it's always something we can work on and move forward and develop with a new member of staff or a new client, i.e. the elderly, as we're talking about that in a topical way. And there's always scope and option there. So it's not that's it, I can't have anybody anymore. It's just, if you're willing to move on and accept another person, then I think that's a great start.
Now, we've heard a lot about care workers and the need to be vaccinated. Do you think that will be something that might put people off?
So far, we've not seen a problem with that to a high level. I think there may be a personal justification at the time that they can't have that vaccination. That's fine. Let's make sure that we can work quite safely with that person, i.e. the member of staff, and vice versa if it's the client. I think it's a plan, but it's certainly moving forward, and I don't think it's a massive obstruction.
Moving back to Lynn, if I may, how can people get more details? And what sort of people are you looking for these jobs?
Well, the main thing to stress here is people with the right values, people who are interested in people, who want to make a difference, people who have respect for people, who are empathetic, reliable, patient, practical, and can observe and see what might need to be done to support somebody. You don't have to have any prior qualifications. You don't even really have to have prior experience. Those values and attributes are the main thing. As Ross said earlier, there's lots of training and support available to give you the specific skills things around moving and handling and all those kinds of things. That will all be provided. So it's basically the right values and the right attributes and a passion for it, a passion for people and a passion to make a difference to people's everyday lives by helping to support them. People can go on to the Department of Health and Social Care website, which is adultsocialcare.co.uk, and here they will find everything they need to know about a career in adult social care. And crucially, from there they'll be able to search for social care jobs near them through the DWP site Find a Job. So that will all be there for them. So I'll just repeat it: adultsocialcare.co.uk. Just click in there and you'll find out everything you need to know about being a social care worker.
Thank you very much, Lynn. And the final word from Ross: what do you find most rewarding about working in social care in Brighton particularly?
I believe that when you ascertain sometimes how vulnerable our clientele are, and you're able to support that vulnerability to a confidence level to ascertain their purpose within their life again. And then they can have something to look forward to, whether it may be family contact. That's not always an easy, accessible component to life at times. And I feel that if you observe from afar or actually if you put a lot of work into that, then I think you can sit back and just reap the rewards just on a very personal level. I think that's beautiful to see.
I was talking to Lynn Romeo and Ross Penfold, who's a Brighton carer, about working in the care sector. Now, the show that's coming up over Christmas at the Theatre Royal in Brighton is called Everybody's Talking About Jamie. And joining us now is the lady that plays Jamie's friend, whose name is on stage is pretty, and that's Sharon Fall. Hi, Sharon. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks so much for chatting to me today.
Tell us a bit about Everybody's Talking About Jamie.
It's a beautiful story. It's based on a documentary about Jamie Campbell, a boy who wanted to go to his school prom in a dress and the backlash that he faces from that. And so we've been performing it now since, well, we were on before the pandemic, and unfortunately we had to pause, but we've been back on now since September, so we're well into the swing of it, and it's just really, really wonderful to share this story about being who your true self, having the confidence to be that, and the support that you get from those around you. It's wonderful to be able to share that with everyone around the country.
The type of audience that this would appeal to, you might think it was the gay audience, but not necessarily, I gather.
No, absolutely not. This is a story where you see so many different characters reflected on that stage. And what's so beautiful about each and every performer, each and every member of this cast, is they bring something different to their roles. Everything's painted in so much depth that anyone who comes to see it will see themselves reflected on the stage, which is how it should be, and which is actually one of the main reasons why I love this show so much, is because it's a celebration of people, of everyone.
And it's a musical.
Yes. So there's some beautiful songs written by Dan Gillespie-Sells and Tom McRae, who just the script, the score, it just marries together so well. I adore actually the songs that Pretty gets to sing. They have really universal messages of hope and positivity and truth, which is so it's an absolute privilege to be able to sing those every night.
And one of those songs is called Spotlight. And is that your favourite?
I love that. It comes out of a really playful, really wonderful moment between Jamie and Pretty, where you get to see how much she supports Jamie and that she champions him. She's his cheerleader. But as much as she helps him, Jamie also helps her to find her own voice and to have the confidence to take that forward. So I love that scene. I also love the scene in Pretty's bedroom, which goes into It Means Beautiful, because there you see how the two of them lean on each other, and it's such a gorgeous friendship.
What about the reaction in Brighton? How do you think it will go down in our city, where we're used to everything? And in fact, last few weeks we've had the Rocky Horror Show, so a huge difference things happening on stage. And so do you think it will go down in Brighton?
Oh, I cannot wait. We've all been talking about how much we can't wait to get to Brighton, and we've had wonderful audiences all the way throughout. And it's really nice to be able to bring this to people who've never seen the show before, some people who've come again and again, because it has that great big following now, which is really lovely to see. But every time I've been to Brighton, I've absolutely loved it there, and the kind of the culture of being open. And so I think that this story will just translate beautifully. And we're there for a month as well, which is our longest stint in one place, because we've been doing week on in each venue. So it'll be nice to have a little residency there and to explore and to just bring it to as many people in Brighton as possible.
And the final word, the show itself, is it a happy show? Is it a sad show? Or how would you describe it?
It deals with a lot of really important issues. You see Jamie go on a journey where you know, it goes into so much depth about his inner turmoil, his you know, it's not clear cut as is It's so for me, it's very real in that sense. And even with my character, she goes on a big journey of realization, and that, you know, that comes with its ups and downs. But I think the heart of it is a positive celebration. So then what you come out of it with is such a life affirming, feel good show at the end of it, going through all of that and seeing truth reflected on a stage.
We were joined by Sharon Full, who plays Jamie's friend Pretty. But now, as our 60 minutes of airtime is nearly up, there's just about time for a goodbye from me. And so, until we next meet over the airwaves, or however you listen, please don't forget that both my co-presenter, Richard Davis, and I will be here with the next Christmas, would you believe, edition in a couple of weeks. For the past hour, you've been listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb. And you can listen again to a selection of some of the editions of the show by entering either Radio Reverb or Grey Matters Productions CIC into your internet browser, selecting the Listen Again tab, and then choosing the actual show or shows you'd like to hear again. Until next time we are together, this is Chris English, signing off with my usual plea for you to all keep safe and well, and please don't forget to encourage all of the young people you know to get their jabs. Bye for now.